Healthcare Today is produced and paid for by the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to wdev@radiovermont.com.
Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Hello, this is Dr. Lewis Myers, and you are on Healthcare Today. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to be talking today about a problem which affects so many Americans and increasingly people around the world, and that is obesity and weight management. And I want to emphasize that this is not about fat shaming or social issues. It is about the physical and mental health complications and that overweight can produce. We have two guests today, Mr. Bill Schubert, who is a Vermont businessman, college trustee, and published author, and Dr. Angela Fitch, who is a physician in Boston and is the associate director of the Weight Management Center at the Massachusetts General Hospital. I want to tell you a bit about each of these guests, and I appreciate them being here. Mr. Schubert is going to talk to us about his experiences with weight gain and weight loss over the course of his life. I also want to mention that he's an author. One of his books is called Lila and Theron. It's a very lovely short novel about two young individuals growing up in the early 20th century rural Vermont, and I highly recommend it. Mr. Schubert, welcome. Thank you for being on the show, and as I mentioned, you have struggled with some weight issues throughout your life, and I thought we would hear about some of your experiences and what they've meant to you.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me on. It's an issue that has really dominated my life, and at 75, I still tip the scales at about 280, but seem to be in relatively good health and don't take any medication, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed. And it's an irony for me because throughout my younger years, I was told by everyone, and certainly those in the medical community, that at my weight I would never survive beyond the age of 50. And I absolutely believed that because, you know, you of all the people in the community that you trust, you know, your doctor is really one of the principal sources of that trust. And I heard it from my doctor at school, my doctor at college, and my doctor in the community growing up in Morrisville. And so I was really had prepared myself to live, you know, some maybe as late as 50, but no longer.
Can you just give us an idea of how old you were when you it was recognized that you were overweight, and how overweight were you?
Yeah, I was actually born very normal weight. I think it was 7'2". And when I was about 8 years old, I began to put on weight. And my mother had struggled both with an eating disorder and other addictions as well, both drugs and alcohol. And I, you know, at that age, you're particularly susceptible to, you know, relating to your mother and father. And we just began to eat together. And that I began to equate that with maternal affection and bonding. And I began to put on weight really significantly at age 8 and kept putting it on.
What was the heaviest that you tipped the scales?
490 pounds.
And how old were you then?
42. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the interesting thing about that, of course, is you can't weigh yourself. And I'd made a decision to go into treatment, and they needed to know my weight. And so I called this friend of mine at Agway, and I said, listen, have you got a platform scale that I can weigh myself on? And he said, sure, and I went down, and, of course, the entire staff was there all excited, and I climbed onto this old Fairbanks Morse weighing scale and was amazed to find that I weighed 490 pounds because, you know, most scales only went up to 250 in those days.
And how was that affecting your life at age 42 to be a 490 pounds?
It was really, I sort of hit bottom. I mean, I was a businessman and had to do a lot of flying around the country, and I couldn't fit in airline seats. And I was always terrified when I got on a plane because I couldn't sit without lifting the divider. And if I lifted the divider, of course, I was moving into someone else's seat. And if the plane was crowded, I was going to, you know, make somebody else's trip miserable. I had struggled with going up multiple flights of stairs, couldn't find clothes. I mean, all of the classic stuff. But more than anything, I was ashamed of myself and didn't understand much about the compulsion to eat. Just kept eating. And
were you developing any associated health problems at that point, given your weight?
Not really. I mean, it's bizarre, and it's probably because I've always been a hard physical worker. I've always worked in the woods and worked with stone, and at 75, we still heat our house with 6 cords of wood, much of which I cut and split. So I've always been very active physically, but that's the only reason I can imagine that I didn't die. I mean, if I'd sat down in a bark lounger and watched TV, I doubt I would have lived past 50.
Did you have any siblings that struggled with their weight?
Yes, both of them, but they were more successful and considerably less compulsive than I, and they're both alive today. And interestingly, my mother was diabetic, and both my siblings are either diabetic or pre-diabetic, and I get, of course, tested every year, and I'm not pre-diabetic.
When you said you were a compulsive eater, can you talk a little bit about that? What did you mean by that?
Well, it's actually, it's very simple. I mean, the most clarifying thing I can say to you is, if you said to me, my best friend died, I would sit down and start eating crackers or bread. I was not a sugar person because sugar had way too strong a psychotropic reaction for me. But I could sit down and eat an entire box of saltines or Ritz crackers or whatever. But if you said to me, hey, you just won a Pulitzer Prize or you've just been elected governor, I would do the same thing. And I couldn't make sense of that. But I since have, and that it was actually any emotional high or low was what I was struggling to manage. So whether it was good news or bad news, I would find myself eating.
I want to just let our listeners know, I'm sure there are many people out there who have been working on their own weight issues. Mm-hmm. I would like to give our phone number if you'd like to ask any questions of our guests or make any comments about your own experience. You can call us at 802-244-1777. That's 802-244-1777. So, Mr. Schubert, at what point did you begin to turn this around and begin to take control of it?
I actually realized it was a matter of life or death. And, you know, I had to deal with it, and that, as I say, was in my early 40s. And I looked around, and I did not have a lot of money, so I couldn't afford to go to a fancy spa or any of that. And I heard about a place in Florida, and it was affordable, and it was covered by my insurance, and I just signed on. And I spent 30 days there, and it was, I learned more about eating disorder and food addiction than I had ever even imagined. And the essence of what I learned there was, is that the moderation model in food doesn't work for people who are really addicted to food. It's like it doesn't work for alcohol and it doesn't work for fentanyl or heroin. The only model that works is abstinence. And what I learned there was I wasn't addicted to complex carbohydrates or to proteins. I was addicted to refined carbohydrates. It was always bread and crackers and pasta. And so if I exercised absolute abstinence, no sugar, flour, or wheat, the compulsion would gradually diminish. And in my 30 days there, I followed it strictly. They provided all the meals. I had no refined carbohydrates in any degree, and yet I was full and felt satisfied. And after several weeks, the compulsion really did start to go down. And I lost 44 pounds while I was there. And over the course of the next 2 years, I lost some 250 pounds safely and slowly, eating three meals a day, but just avoiding refined carbohydrates.
So at that point, you were down to about 250 pounds,
right,
thereabouts. And then were there other treatment options that you used over the years?
When I started to put a little bit of weight on, I went to the rice diet place, but found for just a week, and found it not particularly compelling, at least for me. And came back and really went back to absolute abstinence from refined carbohydrates and brought my weight back down to where I needed it and wanted it to be.
Have you been able to keep the weight off over the years?
Yes. It's funny because 280 pounds or 275, I fluctuate between 270 and 280. And when I creep up to 280, I'm just more careful. But what's intriguing to me is the compulsion is gone. I don't any longer feel that if I have a wave of emotion, I have to sit down and start eating crackers or bread or pasta. And so it's really quite easy to manage. I don't go hungry. I eat a lot of fruit, a lot of vegetables. I eat meat, fish, but again, that crazy compulsion's not there. And sometimes I'll sit down and say, well, you know, it'd be nice to, you know, have a little bit more of that steak. And then I go, well, I don't need it. You know, it's a very different mindset. I don't feel beset by this compulsion to eat.
This is a hopeful story from Mr. Bill Schubert, and I wonder if it has resonance for people who are listening. I want to bring in Dr. Fitch now and just tell you a little bit more about her. And by the way, one of the reasons I chose this topic is as an internal medicine doctor, whether it's in the office or the hospital, I can say that so many of the problems we see are related to overweight. If not caused by overweight, they're exacerbated by it. And I'm talking about high blood pressure, diabetes, arthritis, sleep apnea, some mental health disorders, and some cancers, as we're discovering. So I want to bring in Dr. Angela Fitch, tell you just a little bit more about her. Dr. Fitch is a native of Iowa, born in Waterloo, Iowa, got her Bachelor's of Science in Chemical Engineering at the Iowa State University, her MD at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. She did a four-year combined residency in both pediatrics and in internal medicine at the University of Cincinnati, did an additional year of training in Cambridge, England, and then came back to the University of Cincinnati to be chief resident for a year, is currently the associate director of the Weight Management Center at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, which is where she's calling us from. Dr. Fitch, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Myers. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've been listening to Mr. Schubert, and I'm sure you see many, many people with, if not identical stories, similar stories. But tell me, what drew you into the field of weight management as both internist and pediatrician?
Yes, well, I can certainly relate to Mr. Schubert's story. I mean, we do, hear these sorts of issues every day in our practice and in our work. I was a primary care physician for 10 years and practiced in a very busy primary care practice in Minneapolis. And during the course of that time, I really was, I was always fascinated, even as a resident and medical student, with metabolism and how our body metabolizes different nutrients, right? And how that can be deranged in some people and how that can be an issue that can cause other diseases like polycystic ovarian syndrome and diabetes, as you mentioned. And so I as a primary care physician, I did a lot of work with patients with diabetes. And then out of that too, people would come in and ask me, they'd say, well, how do I lose weight? And I would be like, no one ever taught me that really in school or residency, because that was 20 years ago. And we really weren't teaching people that, right? I mean, people were left to sort of what Mr. Schubert described in terms of figuring out for themselves sort of, where do I go and what do I do and how do I get help for this? And so that really drew me towards getting specialized in obesity medicine, because now there is a specialty by the American Board of Obesity Medicine. And at the time, we have a fellowship here at Boston at the Massachusetts General Hospital now. So people, after they get done with residency, can do a year or two fellowship to learn, how to treat obesity, both medically and surgically and behaviorally, as Mr. Schubert nicely discussed. So, that really sort of prompted me to specialize in obesity medicine. And then when I did that, I decided to start doing that full time.
I would just add one thought, and that is, having been in primary care for many years, is that, and I don't know what, it's been many years since I've been in medical school, but I would agree that medical students were not, and perhaps still are not, taught a lot about nutrition and metabolism. And then once they get into practice in the current primary care, most primary care offices where people are seeing patients every 15 minutes, it's very hard to adequately address weight management issues in that kind of time frame. Would you agree?
Yes, that is very much a challenge. It's a challenge I found, and one of the reasons I sort of, went off to do the work full time, because it does afford me a little bit more time to work with patients. And then also, we have a team of people too, because I do believe it takes a village, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it takes everybody working together, and whether that's dietitian, psychologist, health coach, someone who can work with you and help you with your goals and what you're trying to accomplish.
I want to talk a little bit about the team and the program you have at Mass General, but let's talk about obesity for a minute. Can you define what we mean by obesity, and can you give us some numbers, both in terms of the pediatric adolescent population and adult population, in terms of the numbers now in this country?
Yes. So, currently, it depends on where you live in the country. We're fortunate here in New England that our obesity rates are a little bit lower than other places in the country. But anywhere between 30 and 40%, depending on ethnicity and, like I said, other factors as to where you live, of people in our country struggle with obesity. It's expected, actually, a study published out of Harvard School of Public Health here last year that showed that that obesity rate is expected to go above 50% in the next couple of years. So,
now, how are you defining obesity?
Really, it's a challenge. So, obesity is technically defined, as it is today, as a body mass index, which is a calculation done by your weight divided by your height squared, and that calculation then associates with what's called a body mass index. And if your BMI is greater than 30 as an adult, then you have the disease of obesity by definition. And then for pediatrics, we use growth charts, which many people are familiar with. Maybe if they have children and they take them to the doctor, the growth chart, and you're supposed to be on a trajectory of growth because our pediatric patients are growing, right? And so we also have a growth chart for the body mass index. And so if a child's body mass index is greater than what we call the 95th percentile, so if a child's body mass index is higher than 95% of other children, then that would be is considered obesity.
You mentioned the trajectory that we may be even still on the upward trajectory. Going back a generation, let's say 25, 30 years, how have the numbers changed?
The numbers really changed radically. There's some nice graphical illustrations on the internet that you can find. The numbers actually radically changed in the early 80s, actually, in the 1980s, is when the numbers started to distinctly, I mean, the obesity rate in our country was pretty flat. Up until the early 1980s, late 1980s, when the rates started to take off. And there's a several, hypotheses around that. And certainly it's worth mentioning that obesity is a complicated disease. Mr. Schubert mentioned in his journey that with the disease that, you know, it started when he was younger, which typically means then that there is some genetic influence. He mentioned some of his family history of people with diabetes in his family. And again, when that the state of diabetes as a disease of diabetes is a complicated metabolic health condition that promotes the storage of fat as energy. And so when you have that desire of the human body to store energy, it's also then, you know, harder to get rid of it, right, or harder to make it go away.
You mentioned that there are several hypotheses about why, since the early 80s, we've seen the increase in obesity. What are some of the major hypotheses?
So it's, again, like I said, if you look at an obesity systems map, which is an interesting newer way of looking at things today where there's system scientists that overlap, you know, all the different factors that play roles in different issues, right? And in the case of obesity, it's a very complicated map that has sort of individual psychology, as Mr. Schubert talked about in his discussion there, and then family history, genetics. So the changes that happened around about in the late 80s in particular was the increase in processed food development, right? So it became very commonplace to have a lot of different processed carbohydrates, as Mr. Schubert talked about. And as we developed high fructose corn syrup in particular, that is when high fructose corn syrup became available. So I grew up in Iowa, and around about that time when I was in high school, we had something called Farm Aid because Willie Nelson came to play at our cattle congress, and it was very exciting because a big star came to play at our little town. And I remember it distinctly, and it was because the farmers were going out of business. The farmers were going bankrupt, and so they supported farming with with government support to grow corn and to transition a lot of the farming that was being done over to corn production. And then when they had all this corn, the U.S. government had to decide what to do with all this corn. And then there was a lot of research at my alma mater, Iowa State University, in terms of how we can use corn, you know, in gasoline, in ethanol, other products, and then the development of high fructose corn syrup was developed. And so because of high fructose corn syrup, it allowed us to make a lot of shelf-stable processed food. And so that is one of the theories around, you know, that was happening at the same time also, that women were going more into the workplace. There were two family working households, right, or two adults in the working household. And so with that came more desire for convenience foods and things that we could, you know, things that we could eat quickly because, you know, we were busier.
We're going to have to go to a break in a minute. There's a lot more to talk about in the second half, and please give us a call if you would like to share your thoughts at 802-244-1777. Back shortly. We're back for our second half of the hour with Mr. Bill Schubert and Dr. Angela Fitch. Dr. Fitch, you were talking before the break about some of the reasons why weight in America started to go up in the early 80s. There's a question of nature versus nurture. So sometimes you see one or both parents who are heavy, and then you see one of the children starting to gain weight. When you see a patient for initial intake at Mass General, how much attention do you pay to that?
Yes, yeah, so we pay attention to, you know, what we were talking about briefly with obesity rates increasing, right? It's very complicated, and there are issues related to genetics, there are issues related to behavior, learned behaviors. Mr. Schubert talked about his association between, you know, food and feeling cared for or loved, or associating that with, you know, with the relationship with his family. And there's a lot of reasons that we eat, and we investigate sort of all of those different reasons. And then the other things that play a significant role in our fat storage, right, is our sleep or lack of sleep in particular, and stress, right? So all of those things have all changed over these years, right? Stress has gotten worse, sleep has gotten less, our physical movement sometimes has gone down, you know, so all of these things are compounded, and we certainly look at all of these factors as we do an evaluation.
Are we learning more about the genetics of obesity?
We are. In fact, we had our first FDA-approved medication at the end of last year for patients who have a genetic form of obesity. That's a breakthrough in that, you know, we haven't had that yet. We can't change our genes. You know, we can't do gene therapy yet, right, to change these genes. But we're recognizing they exist, at least, and then there are some newer.
What is that particular medicine impact? Where is it working?
So this is on the MC4R receptor. The MC4R is a receptor on our appetite center, and possibly also our metabolic regulation center, which is in our hypothalamus in our brain, sort of tells us if we're hungry, tells us if we're full. For some patients that have surgery or take medication for obesity treatment, it's amazing because they'll just tell me, like, oh, my gosh, I never knew what it was like to feel full. And when you give them that ability, right, they're like, wow, like, you know, now I know what it's like, right? And we think there's probably something genetic or probably some, you know, disconnect between the stomach and the brain and this feeling of fullness. I know I'm like that. Like, I would have friends all the time at lunch. I go to lunch with them, and they'd be like, I'm done, and half their plate is sitting there. And I'd be like, oh, can I eat that? Like, you know, that looks good. Like, so, I mean, people get full, right, at different levels, and we probably all know people, you know, that have heartier appetites than others.
One of the unfortunate parts in terms of medical history, though, in terms of medications for appetite suppression or altering energy metabolism is pretty devastating history in terms of most of the medications that came online actually caused terrible potential side effects and sometimes death. And I'm thinking recently about 15 years ago about medications, Fen-Phen, for example, the Fen part of Fen-Phen, I believe.
Yeah.
But it's not a good history. Are we getting better at learning what's safe and what works?
Yes, I mean, we are getting extremely better. We have some very good medications on the market today, as well as some older medications. Even the phentermine that was in Fen-Phen, unfortunately, got kind of a bad rap because of that, right? But the phentermine has been around since the 1950s and is a very effective medication for obesity treatment. But it also gets a bad rap, too, because there's a lot of stigma around obesity. I think Mr. Schubert mentioned some of that. And it's very stigmatizing. And so we have to get rid of that stigma, right? It's one of the only diseases where 80% of people in the ACTION study that was done, 80% of people with obesity believe that it's completely their own responsibility to fix it. And there's no other diseases like that. If you come in with cancer, you don't say, oh, I'm just going to go home and fix it myself. I mean, not usually. And that's okay if that's the way you believe and, you know, I accept that and we work together, you know, on where you sit with that. But I mean, at the same time, I mean, most of the time, 80% of people are like, please, can you take it out? Can you help me? You know, can you fix it for me? You know, and that's where we're struggling.
That's a very interesting point. Well, let's tell us, if you would, now a little bit about your program at Mass General. I assume there are other programs like this around the country, but you may be one of the programs that's closest to us here in Vermont. What is the weight management program at Mass General? What does it entail?
Yeah, so we're a comprehensive multidisciplinary center that we're actually one of the few centers in the country that treat adults and kids in the same center. So we have a pediatric program and we have an adult program. And we also offer one of the few, you know, one of the centers that offers both medical interventions and surgical interventions in the same center. And really what obesity treatment should be about is, you know, here is my problem, right? Here's what I'm struggling with. And then what kind of tools, you know, do you have in the toolbox to try to improve that or try to treat that, right? Because we're even thinking today, we're even doing studies looking at combinations of treatment. So not only just behavioral treatment, but as Mr. Schubert talked a lot about in his experience, but also medication intervention and then surgical intervention even combined with medication, much like we do, like I said, today with cancer, right? We have surgery for cancer and then we have usually adjunct medication and chemotherapy and radiation, right? And so it's not really a one or the other. It's a comprehensive, like, you know, what's going to be the best treatment plan to get me to where I need to be or where I want to be for my health. That's what we really focus on, right? Some of our patients have to lose 100 pounds because they need a heart transplant, right? Other people want to get rid of their diabetes. Other people don't want to need a liver transplant. The number one reason for liver transplant in our country is quickly becoming non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is where the liver gets damaged by the excess fat stored. So that's a serious thing that people don't want to get, right? And so, you know, we have to help them understand how they're going to get there and give them those opportunities for treatment.
So I would assume it, if I came to your center, I would probably be seeing an internist such as yourself, nutritionist for sure. Probably a social worker, a psychologist, possibly a psychiatrist working with the mental health issues surrounding weight, and then possibly a bariatric surgeon.
Yes.
Can you talk, bariatric surgery, talk to us about what that is, when it started, what developments have we've seen, and where it fits in the treatment armamentarium?
Yes, the most amazing development I think we've seen over the course of the past even, 10 years or so, or even 20 years, is that, you know, surgery, in a recent study, it was just shown that bariatric surgery is as safe as having an appendectomy. And so the safety of the surgery has really come a long way, because, again, it had sort of a bad rap in the day of being something where, you know, people would worry that they would, you know, die from the surgery itself, right?
Well, that was realistic, by the way. When I was in medical school, they were just starting them, and there were some horrendous outcomes back then.
Exactly, and so that's what I mean. That's the biggest thing that we've accomplished today, I think, is perfecting the safety of that procedure. It's done now laparoscopically for the most part for most people, you know, with just just cameras and instruments, so there's no large incisions. And then, you know, there are different forms of surgery nowadays that have been developed that help people in different ways. And so, again, we do an assessment of the patient and make sure, again, that they're psychologically stable to have surgery, because it is another stressful situation to have surgery, and we want to make sure you're in a good place for that. But surgery today is done. We're actually piloting right now at Mass General an outpatient program because of COVID-19 and the hospitalization, you know, the need for hospital beds. And that has pushed us into, you know, piloting even same day, which is very similar to a gallbladder surgery or something like that.
However, I think it's important to note, unlike a gallbladder surgery, that once someone has this bariatric surgery, that they still need intensive follow-up. Is that right?
Yes, so they still need, you know, you still have to work on these same behavior changes that Mr. Schubert talked about, you know, ongoing for the rest of your life. I mean, obesity is a chronic disease, and whatever you do to intervene on it, you have to continue to keep doing that, right? And so, you know, that's where surgery comes into place, is that it allows people to have, surgery is our most robust tool that we have that can give patients the most highest rate of weight loss of all of our treatments today. And so again, you know, depending on the need for weight loss to get rid of some of these other diseases, some people find that that can be their best chance of success.
I would imagine that by the time someone comes to a program such as yours at Mass General, that they have tried many things over perhaps many years in terms of weight loss. Just getting past that frustration point must be a challenge.
Yes, I mean, many people have. I mean, there's some data on it. I can never remember the exact number, but I think it's like on the, you know, definitely in the double digits of times that people have tried, right? And that's the kind of the moral of the story, too. You have to try and try again, because it is a continual problem, right? It doesn't just go away. It's not like a, you know, like you said, like a gallbladder surgery, an appendectomy where you take it out and you're done, right? You have to continue to, you know, work with a team of people typically to continue to have that ongoing success.
At your program, how does exercise come into play?
So exercise is interesting. Mr. Schubert mentioned his own, you know, journey with being fairly active person, and that's great. And it's exercise is great for our cardiovascular fitness. It's great for our mental health. It's certainly great for our joints, and you know, it's good to be strong and be able to, you know, get up out of the chair by yourself when you're 85 years old, 90 years old, right? It's just good to stay strong and be active. The issue is though that exercise in and of itself has been shown in studies to not produce very much weight loss. So when it comes to weight loss itself, exercise is great, again, from all those other reasons we talked about, cardiovascular health, you know, other reasons, but it doesn't produce a lot of weight loss. You have to do a lot of exercise.
What about maintaining weight loss once it's occurred? Does exercise help there?
That is the most important reason, actually, that we promote people, you know, to be physically active, right? So, you know, at the Weight Center, we very much focus on that physical activity piece for that reason, because the most important thing, you hit the nail on the head, for physical activity is in maintaining your weight once you lose it. But you can't outrun your fork. That's the old adage, right? You just can't outrun your fork. You have to be mindful of what you're doing with your intake as well.
So many people are able to lose weight but then find it extremely difficult to maintain the weight loss. And we know that the body has, partly that's the body's response. Can you talk a little bit about that, number one? And number two, is it more dangerous to have weight fluctuations, or is it more dangerous to simply not try?
Yes, I know. That last one there, you know, is still sort of an unknown, right? We really don't know. And I think the most important thing is to recognize that, you know, the human body's natural instinct is to gain weight, right? If we're losing weight, the human body thinks there's something wrong with it, right? Because it was engineered to survive. And if you survived, you were gaining weight, not losing weight. If you were losing weight, something was happening. And so fighting back against that, right, once you lose that weight, like Mr. Schubert talked about, right, keeping your body from going back to that 400-some pounds is really, you know, your body's wanting to go back there. So
basically the metabolism itself changes at that point, doesn't it? The energy metabolism.
Yeah, it's fascinating, right? And we're working on that right now, meaning scientists, you know, at the NIH and other places are really researching this idea of weight maintenance, because it really is a conundrum, because, you know, as you lose weight, you lower your metabolic rate, you know, the amount of calories it's like not fair, right? Because as you lose weight and you're doing better and you're getting healthier, you have to work harder because your body, like, functions, it gets more efficient at functioning on that lower calorie intake. And that's where things like surgery and medications can give you a metabolic edge there that, that allows you to sort of outsmart Mother Nature and really, help with the maintenance as well as the loss in the first place.
Along with your other colleagues, such as the nutritionists, the exercise physiologists, and the psychologists. We want to take a call from Nancy in Frederick, Maryland. Nancy, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi there. I've known many people who have done the zero or low-carb diets, like the keto, for example, and I'm wondering if you can speak to that just a little bit, whether it's sustainable, whether there are any risk factors from them, because it seems like often they just are consuming very high fat as part of that diet. So I was wondering if you could address that.
Thank you.
So it's very interesting. What we also know, too, is that some people, what's going to work for one person might not work for the other person. And that's what also makes it extremely complicated for everybody to sort of, you know, everybody says there's so many diets out there. Well, that's because there's something that works for everybody, and that's where we're getting at precision nutrition and looking at the future is going to be looking at genetics, looking at gut microbiome, because that also plays a role, what our stool bacteria look like, and then, you know, potentially using that sort of data to personalize how our body is going to respond to certain nutrients, right, respond to carbohydrates. Mr. Schubert talked about his sort of some of his issues around emotional relationship with those carbohydrates, which is totally separate from sort of how your body might metabolize them when you eat them. And so the following a low-carb diet is certainly a reasonable plan for a lot of people, but it has to work for you. If you're doing that and you're miserable, like, you know, that's making your life miserable, then that's probably not something you should do, because we should also be, you know, happy with our lives, right? And live a fulfilled, high quality life. So, you know, it might not be for everybody, but certainly for those people that that it works for, then we think that would be, you know, a good choice for them.
One of the you just mentioned how important it is to individualize treatment in this field of treating people who are overweight. Last week we focused on primary care, and I guess in my concluding remarks I mentioned how much of primary care is now being driven by algorithms and, of course, time pressures as well. So it sounds like it's very different in the field of weight management, that individualizing the treatment is extremely important.
It is. I mean, there's some sort of general overarching themes, as I mentioned, you know, it's focusing on optimizing sleep, optimizing stress reduction, nutrition, and as our caller just mentioned, the nutrition piece is really sort of one of the hardest things to kind of figure out, and it takes some trial and error, right? It takes some sort of working with people. It's not as it can't be as clear cut. And when you do things like a low carbohydrate lifestyle, as was mentioned, you want to do it correctly too, right? As a caller mentioned, you know, with the ketogenic lifestyle, it's higher fat. With the Atkins lifestyle, it's higher protein. But we only have three nutrients: protein, carbohydrates, and fat. So if you lower carbohydrates, you have to raise up one of the other two. And it's important, too, right, that we're eating healthy fats, right? So there was this sort of picture of the old Atkins diet or the mm-hmm. keto diet where people are just eating a bunch of bacon.
You can have your cake and eat it, too, sort of diet.
Yeah, that's probably not the right way to do it. There's probably right ways to do that, meaning eating, you know, salmon and broccoli, right, which is a very low-carbohydrate meal and very healthy for you. And that's why we tend to focus on the middle ground, too, right, because for some people, if they need to go to one of those extremes, that might be necessary for them and their biology. But for most of us, if we eat them a good, nice Mediterranean lifestyle, which is as Mr. Schubert mentioned, complex carbohydrates like farro and quinoa and other types of vegetables, right? These are complex carbohydrates, have fiber in them. The processed food environment that we struggle with today, which is 70% of our food environment. And that's the hard part, living into this a lower carbohydrate lifestyle in an environment where 70% of the environment is processed carbohydrates. That makes it very challenging.
That leads right into my next and one of my final questions, and that is, and you've talked already about this, about what is available out there and what is the advertising business and whatnot. There have been some regions, such as New York City during the Michael Bloomberg era, that tried to, for example, limit the number, the size of sodas. Interestingly, more widespread is in Mexico, where they have a big problem with obesity and diabetes. They have, again, limited the amounts of sugar drinks, and they are actually seeing some results. But it's been discussed here in Vermont. Some people call it the nanny state, but others think that it might have some benefit to help put some limits on some of these products. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's very, you know, it's very sometimes politically charged or other reasons, right, as far as that goes. But I think ultimately we should think of these types of processed foods the same way we think of other, you know, other things that we've enjoyed over centuries, right? Like you said, like cake and cookies. I mean, we should have cake and cookies. But we shouldn't certainly, I don't think, you know, market them to, you know, three-year-olds. and that's probably the biggest thing, because trying to, as Mr. Schubert mentioned, you know, trying to moderate those types of foods is very challenging. It's not, we talk a lot about intuitive eating and sort of eating in response to being hungry, right? But intuitive eating sort of goes out the window when you have something that's hyper-palatable. Because if it's hyper-palatable, meaning you really like the taste of it and it's really good, right, you're going to want to eat more and more and more of it, and it can be hard for some people to control that. So I do think, you know, making sure that these things aren't the default in our environment is key, and they've sort of become the default in our environment, unfortunately, because of, you know, big business of those types of products, right?
I want to thank we're going to have to end in just a minute. I do want to thank both of our guests. I'm sorry, Mr. Schubert, that we couldn't bring you back in, but I think what you had to say was extremely helpful. Bill Schubert, who is here in Vermont, and Dr. Angela Fitch, who's at the Mass General. I think the bottom line is this is a significant problem in our community, but that you don't have to feel like you're alone, and you don't have to feel like it's your fault. I think what Dr. Fitch said was very significant in terms of 80% of people somehow feeling that their struggles with obesity are their fault. It's not your fault. But there is help out there, and we encourage you to talk to your primary care provider and start with that, and then go from there. I want to tell you briefly about our show next week. We are going to be talking about how the COVID pandemic is affecting young people and adolescents and children. Certainly, we're just beginning to realize the immense effects that it's having on their lives as we adults struggle through this as well. So I hope you'll join me then. In the meantime, please take good care of yourselves. Be kind to yourselves. Thanks.
Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, brought to you in part by AgeWell Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed. And Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. NorthfieldPharmacy.com.
The music for this program was written and produced by Armin Bayajian.